Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, April 14th, 2026. And here are today's news briefs. Appeals Court orders end of contempt investigation of Trumped deportation flights. It ruled that a federal judge must end his contempt investigation of the Trump administration for failing to comply with an order over flights carrying Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador last year. The divided appeals court panel made that ruling Tuesday. The panel majority said Chief Judge James Boasberg abused his discretion in forging ahead with criminal contempt proceedings stemming from the March 2025 deportation flights. 4:34 p.m. ET, Associated Press. Cameroon separatists announce three-day ceasefire for Pope's visit. In a statement to Reuters, the Unity Alliance cited the papal visit's profound spiritual importance for the pause in fighting. Pope Leo, whose 11-day trip of Africa began with a call for fraternal coexistence in Muslim-majority Algeria, is holding a meeting for peace at a cathedral in Cameroon on Thursday. A decade of fighting between English-speaking separatists and a majority French-speaking nation has killed some 6,000 people and displaced well over 500,000. Unity Alliance pledged safe travel for civilians and pilgrims, endorsing a deliberate commitment to responsibility, restraint, and respect for human dignity. 3:41 p.m. ET, staff. Peru runoff presidential election set for June 7th. Keiko Fujimori, daughter of the late President Alberto Fujimori, was the top vote-getter in Sunday's election with 35 candidates. Voters who identified public safety and political stability as top issues appeared to favor Keiko for her name recognition and iron fist toward crime. Voting was marred by logistical delays that prompted extension of voting and underscored institutional weaknesses in a country that has had 9 presidents since 2016. Ms. Fujimori's opponent in June was still not clear, with vote counting continuing Tuesday, but it could be former Lima Mayor Rafael Lopez Aliagua, a far-right populist. 2:47 p.m. ET, staff. Renowned Hampshire College to close. Hampshire College, a 6-decade-old liberal arts school in Amherst, Massachusetts, has announced it is closing its doors. The college, whose graduates include documentarian Ken Burns and actress Lupita Nyong'o, has for years battled declining enrollment. As fewer students enroll, more than a quarter of private colleges, many of them small and rural, are at risk of closing, NPR recently reported. Almost 2.3 million fewer students enrolled in undergraduate programs in 2023 compared to 2010, according to federal data. 12:51 p.m. ET, staff. Ukraine claims to win a battle using just robotics. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed that for the first time in the war with Russia, it used unmanned robotic vehicles and drones to overwhelm an enemy position. The occupiers surrendered, and the operation was carried out without infantry and without losses on our side, Mr. Zelensky wrote on X. He said that Ukraine's ground-based robotic systems have carried out 22,000 missions in 3 months, touting long-range drones and naval drones built by Ukraine's defense industrial complex. Mr. Zelensky said that his country's technology is indispensable because it can help others. 10:04 a.m. ET, staff. Pakistan proposes new U.S.-Iran talks as Trump administration hints at progress. Pakistani officials on Tuesday said Islamabad has proposed a second round of talks to the U.S. and Iran. Vice President J.D. Vance earlier said negotiations with Iran made some progress, and Mr. Trump said Monday they had been contacted by the other side and they want to work a deal. 6:50 a.m. ET, Associated Press. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney's Liberals secured a majority government. Wins in three by-elections Monday gave them a majority in the House of Commons. In April 2025, the Liberals were polling 20 points behind the Conservatives, under threats of annexation and tariffs by President Trump. Canadians rallied behind the former central banker, handing the Liberals a win but not a majority. Since then, five members of Parliament, including four Conservatives, have defected to the Liberals. Popular at home, Mr. Carney has received international attention, too, after a speech in Davos calling for middle powers to unify against the bullying of great powers. 6:49 a.m. ET, staff. Night sky welcomes extremely rare comet. The famous Halley's Comet, which orbits the Sun every 72 to 80 years, is a relatively frequent visitor compared to Comet C2025R3. The latter was last seen in these parts 170,000 years ago, but Space.com reports that C2025R3 will once again be visible in the Northern Hemisphere between now and April 20th. The best time to view it is near the eastern horizon, 60 to 90 minutes pre-dawn. Later this month, it will become visible in Southern Hemisphere evening skies through early May. 5:54 p.m. ET, staff, April 13th, 2026. Our first article is, with Swalwell and Gonzalez out, is Congress entering a new accountability era? By Caitlin Babcock, staff writer. Updated April 14, 2026, 3:26 p.m. ET, Washington. Congress appears to be having a At Me Too, Part 2 moment. This week, Democratic Representative Eric Swalwell of California and Republican Representative Tony Gonzalez of Texas announced their resignations from the U.S. House of Representatives ahead of expected expulsion votes. Both men face serious allegations of sexual misconduct. Notably, each also faced a chorus of calls from colleagues on both sides of the aisle to step down. Fallout from the Epstein scandal and a changing media environment might be contributing to a new push for sunlight and accountability on Capitol Hill. This week's unusual resignations could be followed by even more. The outcry highlights a new push for accountability on Capitol Hill, driven in part by fallout from the Epstein scandal and a media environment in which allegations can spread faster than ever online. To some extent, it's part of a growing call-out culture, with lawmakers increasingly censuring one another as a new weapon in partisan politics. But it also suggests a changing landscape for politicians, as well as for women speaking out about abuses by powerful men. Some, 10 years after the At Me Too movement first exploded across America, even as survivors of the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's crimes say they still haven't seen justice. What's unusual is that the resignations are actually happening. Where there have been ethical lapses in the past and allegations in the past and excuses have been made, says Jennifer Lawless, a politics professor at the University of Virginia and co-author of Women on the Run, gender, media, and political campaigns in a polarized era. Representative Swalwell suspended his campaign for California governor over the weekend after two outlets published accusations of sexual assault by a former staffer, and other women came forward with stories of sexual harassment. In a statement, he denied the most serious allegations, but also apologized for mistakes in judgment. On Tuesday, another woman gave a press conference accusing Mr. Swalwell of sexual assault. Her attorney said they plan to file a police report with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Representative Gonzalez has admitted to an extramarital affair with a staffer who later died by suicide and has faced other accusations of sexual misconduct. Both men officially submitted their resignations to the House on Tuesday afternoon. Two other House members, both from Florida, are also facing calls to resign and potential expulsion votes, though the accusations against them do not involve sexual misconduct. Republican Representative Corey Mills faces accusations ranging from domestic violence to stolen valor, and Democratic Representative Sheila Chiflus McCormick faces federal charges for allegedly stealing $5 million in pandemic relief funds that she used to support her campaign. House Speaker Mike Johnson told reporters Tuesday he believed Representative Chiflus McCormick should be expelled. The House Ethics Committee has opened investigations into all four members. An ethics subcommittee has already found Representative Chiflus McCormick guilty of multiple violations, and the full committee is expected to determine next week what consequences it will recommend. Several members who have been most vocal in calling for these lawmakers to resign or be expelled, like Democratic Representative Ro Khanna of California and Republican Representative Ana Paulina Luna of Florida, were also outspoken in demanding the release of files related to Mr. Epstein. The steady drip of information from those released files detailing many public figures' connections with the disgraced financier has ignited a firestorm of public anger and mistrust. Former Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene drew a direct line between the resignations in Congress and the upheaval caused by the Epstein files, arguing that much more still needs to change. Both congressmen who resigned were linked to Jeffrey Epstein type sexual issues, she wrote in a post on the social platform X. To this day, no one in the Epstein files has been prosecuted, and Congress is still a cesspool. I think the Epstein stuff is probably creating more pressure on people not to let bad behavior go unaddressed, says Michael Gerhardt, a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with expertise in legal ethics. The fact that the members of Congress currently facing calls for expulsion are divided evenly between Republicans and Democrats has also made it easier for lawmakers to take a stand. This week's departures will not change the balance of power in the House. Allegations about Mr. Gonzalez surfaced months ago, leading him to end his reelection campaign in March. But with the House Republicans holding an exceedingly slim majority, Speaker Johnson showed little inclination to push him to an early exit. That calculation changed when information began to come out about Mr. Swalwell, as he campaigned for California governor, leading to calls for his removal. If Gonzalez would have resigned 4 or 5 days ago before Representative Swalwell resigned, I don't know what the Democrats would have done, says Dr. Lawless. Historically, it's very rare for Congress to expel one of its members. The process requires a two-thirds vote in the House or Senate, all but ensuring bipartisan agreement. Only 6 members have ever been expelled, with the most recent being former New York Republican Representative George Santos in 2023. Prior to this week's resignations, Representative Luna had planned to file a motion to expel Mr. Swalwell, while Democratic Representative Teresa Laguerre Fernandez of New Mexico was leading an effort to expel Mr. Gonzalez. Richard Painter, who served as chief ethics lawyer to former President George W. Bush, says the recent rare discussions around expelling 4 members at once raise difficult questions about balancing Congress's authority to police itself with the will of the voters who elected those members into office. When you start expelling members because you say their conduct is unfit, that can dramatically change the outcome of the electoral process and what the Constitution intends, he says. And so I think there needs to be a very high bar for that. With regards to Representatives Swalwell and Gonzalez, Mr. Painter says he believes that bar has been met. Some congressional experts note that members seem to be increasingly taking it upon themselves to call out their colleagues' misbehavior, particularly those of the opposing party. Last November, at least 4 different members from both parties introduced resolutions to censure other members over the course of 1 week. A censure resolution is a symbolic measure to formally condemn a member for misconduct. Some of these members' colleagues became so frustrated with these votes taking up floor time that they tried to pass a law to raise the bar to censure someone. According to Professor Gerhard, tribal politics and a tit-for-tat culture in Congress has fed into the latest momentum around censuring and expulsion. People are trying to outdo each other in terms of what kind of harm they can do to each other, he says. With that kind of mentality already set up in the House, then when you get information that feeds it, it gets extremely intense, and we have the circumstance we've got now. And here's an opinion piece by the Monitor's View on the same subject. Better at Me Too scrutiny on Capitol Hill. In the seat of American electoral power, women in Congress are leading the charge for politicians to uphold workplace ethics, transparency, and respectful treatment. Their efforts reflect society's higher expectations for elected representatives. By the Monitor's editorial board, April 14, 2026, 3:45 p.m. ET. Bipartisan agreement on Capitol Hill is rare these days, but it has been in evidence in recent weeks among a handful of Congresswomen concerned about allegations of sexual misconduct by a few House members. They have called for Congress to expel 3 representatives and to publicly release records of its recent investigation, a motion voted down in early March. Women deserve to be safe, Republican Representative Nancy Mace of South Carolina said last month, and the American people deserve to know when elected officials are abusing power instead of serving their constituents. On Monday, 2 House members announced they would step down. Democrat Eric Swalwell of California, who denies allegations of sexual assault by a former staff member and 3 other women, and Republican Tony Gonzalez of Texas, who has admitted to an affair with an aide. Nearly a decade after the At Me Too movement gained prominence, these events signal that Americans' expectations of elected officials, public and private ethics have changed, to demand greater transparency and accountability, as well as congruence between both. In 2018, we saw a real acknowledging of problems in the halls of power, especially affecting female staffers. Veteran congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins said on NPR this week, that year, Congress tossed out the long-standing practice of using taxpayer money to settle claims of misconduct by elected officials, as well as a rule that required staff to accept up to 90 days of counseling, mediation, and cooling off before lodging a formal complaint. Since then, Ms. Desjardins noted, it's been taken for granted that this problem has been solved. Clearly, there is more work to be done to extend recognition of and respect for women's autonomy and inherent ability to contribute freely and fully in political and public life, especially among women themselves. Women, even those who are highly educated, well-credentialed, and politically engaged, often do not see themselves as viable candidates for office, a 2022 study found. Until women are just as likely as men to consider running for office, the researchers concluded, we really haven't achieved full inclusion. Today, women constitute 28% of the membership of the current 119th Congress. While this is a substantial increase of 44%, between 2015 and 2025, more than half of all American adults feel there are too few women in high office. There are varied reasons behind the desire for more women in politics. Increased representation of women in elected office is associated with counteracting corruption and having a greater focus on public service delivery, according to a global survey by the London-based Westminster Foundation for Democracy and King's College. When women take part in politics, the whole society benefits. And again, from the Monitor's view, we have times of forgiveness and redemption. This year's celebrations of Eid, Easter, and Passover underscore enduring values and aspirations that speak to religious adherents, as well as those who may no longer take part in traditional observances. By the Monitor's editorial board. Within a span of 3 weeks, the world's main monotheistic religions have marked significant annual observances: Ramadan for Muslims, Easter for Christians, and Passover for Jews. Specific worship practices during these periods of prayer and reflection differ, but they all touch on common themes of forgiveness as well as redemption or liberation, both from severe external dangers and harsh inner sentiments. Forgiveness forms an important part of what it means to be a Christian and to be a follower of many other major religions too. Financial Times columnist Gemma Kelly wrote recently, in addition to benefiting individuals, she noted, it can allow nations to heal after decades of conflict and bridge the kind of deep divides we now see in our societies. Celebrating Eid at the end of Ramadan is all about forgiving people, according to Sadaf Farooqi, a writer and Islamic educator based in Karachi, Pakistan. The day's gifts, visiting, and shared meals are for everyone, not just for those whom we like, she wrote in an online post, with a call to develop the ability and strength to forgive others and move on from past grievances. News reports and social media posts over the past year indicate that mercy and empathy are sometimes seen as weaknesses rather than moral virtues. In the United States, political rhetoric around domestic and international differences might seem to bear this out. Yet there are signs that individuals yearn to place their trust in values and a power that goes beyond personality or politics. People tell me all the time that they are searching for richer, more meaningful lives, according to Lauren Jackson, who writes for Believing, a weekly newsletter on religion in the New York Times. Some of this meaning, Ms. Jackson said, is found in redemption stories, tales of trial, triumph, and deliverance to a new world of possibilities. Passover and Easter offer examples of such deliverance, the former marking the Jews' escape from enslavement in ancient Egypt, the latter venerating Jesus' resurrection after being crucified, as well as his forgiving spirit. A liberative story offers freedom for everyone. Theologian and Wheaton College professor Esau McCulley told the New York Times, "It offers the transformation of the person and the society." The past week has offered evidence of liberative stories at a global and individual level. In the successful launch of the Artemis II lunar mission and the weekend rescue of two downed U.S. airmen in Iran. In an Easter message from space to a worldwide audience, Artemis crew member Victor Glover said of our planet, "In all of this emptiness, you have this oasis, this beautiful place that we get to exist together. This," he said, "is an opportunity for us to remember who we are." In his first radio message, sent after about 24 hours of surviving in a remote mountainous region in Iran, the second U.S. airman simply affirmed, "God is good." This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. From Asia, South and Central, we have, on a question of morality, the U.S. and Canada are oceans apart. Why? By Mark Sappenfield, Senior Global Correspondent, Sarah Miller Lana, Staff Writer, Audrey Thiebert, Ismira Luftia Tasnabarata, Special Contributor. April 14, 2026, 2:30 p.m. ET, Berlin, Toronto, Boston, and Jakarta, Indonesia. This year, the Pew Research Center decided to try something new. In its annual survey on global views of morality, it added a fresh question for its respondents from around the world. Do you feel the ethics and morals of others in your country are good? The United States finished last. Researchers asked people from different countries to rank the morality and ethics of their fellow citizens. The results could offer insights into how communities can rebuild trust. It was the only country among the 25 surveyed where more than half of respondents rated the ethics and morals of people in their country as somewhat bad or very bad. Canada, which usually ranks similarly to the U.S. in such surveys, finished first. Some 92% of Canadians rated fellow Canadians as having somewhat good or very good ethics and morals. It was a perplexing result, running dramatically against long-time trends shown by similar studies. "There's no paper out there that explains this," says Joshua Conrad Jackson, a behavioral scientist at the University of Chicago. "We don't really know what's going on in the survey." Researchers are trying to piece together what it might mean. Given that this was the first time the question was ever asked, was it a blip, an outlier, or has it unearthed something new about how Americans think about morality and each other? No one is willing to say that they have the answer, but a range of theories have given fresh fuel to escalate to decades-long conversations about polarization and social trust. Do Americans increasingly see one another as unethical? Not everyone thinks that's necessarily what the survey highlights, but looking at the U.S., Canada, and Indonesia, which came fractionally second to Canada in the Pew survey, offers insights and ideas to consider, if not definitive answers. And it suggests potential ways back for the U.S. Not only are moral views of one another often wrong, but America was also once a global leader in overcoming entrenched lines of division. There are many theories about this. Part of the challenge with drawing firm conclusions from this particular survey is that researchers are not entirely sure what respondents are telling them. Morality is a difficult subject to quantify. People disagree on the definition, and some respondents deny that it is even a thing. For that reason, studies on morality are often closely linked with similar studies on ethics, kindness, or trust. In the past, these studies have revealed several findings that generally hold true across societies and over time. Respondents think the morality of those close to them is stronger than the morality of those they don't know, and they believe that morality in society is getting worse. The results of the latest Pew survey don't fit neatly into either of these trends. Adam Masternamy, a social psychologist who one colleague says knows more about this topic than anyone in the world, is stumped. It appears to be out of step with a lot of other surveys we've seen, says Mr. Matramaniani, author of the science newsletter Experimental History. But he has a theory. Here's what I think might be happening, he says, in an email conversation. When you ask Canadians, how moral are Canadians, they hear that question as, how moral is Canada compared to other relevant countries? And they say very moral, because in the news, they mainly see other countries blowing each other up. Otherwise, why would so many Canadians say other Canadians are moral, when in other surveys, Canadians routinely say nearly half of Canadians can't be trusted? Pew's Kristen Lesage is loath to draw conclusions, even as an author of the study. But a few things stick out to her. Usually, young adults and older adults have broadly similar views on trends and morality. But on this question, younger adults in the U.S. were an outlier. They were more likely to see other Americans as having bad morals and ethics. Pew has data on Christians and religiously affiliated people in 17 countries. In half of those countries, including the U.S., people who are not religiously affiliated are more likely than Christians to rate morality as bad. The data does appear to have a political element. In the U.S. and beyond, respondents who support the party out of power are more likely to see others as having bad morals. Pew's question might hint at an effective polarization, says Dr. Jackson. This is deeper than political polarization. It's polarization based on what you think of others generally. In other words, do you feel a strong connection with like-minded people and strong negative emotions towards others? Data shows clearly that the U.S. has high accelerating levels of effective polarization. In fact, Dr. Jackson says, when you overlay one respected study about effective polarization around the world on the Pew question, the rank order of countries roughly matches. The big outlier in that case is Canada, which normally scores lower. But Keith Newman, a senior associate at the Environics Institute, a Canadian polling firm, says that might be a matter of timing. The question from Pew was posed at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump took office threatening to annex Canada. Canada was feeling an existential threat. That has a unifying tendency, says Dr. Newman. In many ways, the data reveals Indonesia as an interesting case study, says Dr. Lesage of Pew. In his Global Morality Report, the survey asked respondents to consider the morality of 9 behaviors, including divorce, extramarital affairs, and gambling. Indonesia is among the strictest across the board, seeing almost all the behaviors as immoral. That might seem to indicate a society with harsh moral judgments of others. But the reverse is true. As in Canada, 92% of Indonesians saw their fellow Indonesians as somewhat moral or very moral. Part of that can be attributed to having the shared values of a dominant religion. Nearly 90% of Indonesians are Muslim. Laws and institutions in Indonesia are still strongly influenced by religious values, although they are often paraphrased in more universal language, says Nadia Yovani, a sociologist at the Universitas Indonesia and Depok. The Muslim concept of five daily prayers, she says, teaches discipline and regularity. This value of discipline is then reflected in social rules, such as the obligation to arrive on time at school or work, she adds. The Muslim concept of five daily prayers, she says, teaches discipline and regularity. This value of discipline is then reflected in social rules. The same dynamic holds true in Sweden, though in a different way. Sweden ranked fourth in the Pew question, with 88% of Swedes saying other Swedes were somewhat good or very good morally. But that is based on a strong shared ethic grounded in secular humanism. Yet Indonesia has also done something else. Back in 1945, in an effort to unite the vast and culturally diverse archipelago into one nation, Indonesia's founders outlined an official state ideology known as Pancasila. Its five principles promote religious tolerance and an embrace of the moral traditions of all Indonesia's faiths. Today, references to Pancasila abound, from Jakarta gift shops to church facades in Borneo. For a heterogeneous society like Indonesia, Pancasila provides common ground that allows different groups to coexist, says Tubagus Haryo Karbibayananto, Secretary General of Forum Warga Kota, a non-governmental organization advocating on social issues. Dr. Yovani notes that in the end of Ramadan, when Muslims break a full month of fasting during the day, non-Muslims in Indonesia will often prepare the first celebratory meal for their Muslim neighbors. Pancasila touches on something deep in the Indonesian identity, others agree. Such traditions have long been part of everyday life, says Elfrida Manurang, a postgraduate student at Indonesian Christian University in Jakarta. So whether or not Pancasila exists, Indonesian society already has moral values inherited from its cultural heritage. Canada looks to similar historical influences. John Ralston Saul, a Canadian essayist and novelist, argues that well before Canada became a nation, it was constructed upon a triangular foundation of three distinct peoples, Indigenous, French, and English, and in an isolated northern climate, they all had to work together to survive. So the idea that you could have a country which was based in a kind of cooperation between differences without removing the differences, and make this a way of life, then you've got something quite interesting, he says. I think that that's sort of the basis of what Canada is. In 1867, modern Canada was founded on peace, order, and good government, in contrast with the American concept of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, notes Michael McMillan, a co-founder of the Samara Center for Democracy in Toronto. It's perhaps accurate, maybe fanciful, that Canadians get along better because we needed to get along better, he says. Or maybe that's what we were taught to believe. And there are cracks in American polarization. For its part, the U.S. has a motto on every piece of currency that should evoke the same sense of collectivism, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. But that founding ideal is being put to the test. The rise of effective polarization is steeper in the U.S. than in any other country surveyed, says Dr. Jackson. Yet researchers have found that views about the morality and trustworthiness of others are often built on false perceptions, both in the U.S. and beyond. People think other people dislike them more than they dislike others, says Dr. Jackson. The driver of effective polarization is, I don't like them because they don't like me. Michael Jackson has been thinking a lot about morality recently. He's studying it in his college philosophy class in Las Vegas. On a recent visit to Boston, he struggles for his own definition, but says people do seem too quick to judge others today. For sure, people go, oh, you don't agree with me? So maybe you must be an idiot, so I hate you, he says. The reasons for this are a matter of debate. Some point to the rise of social media and cable news. Others point to trends in geography, with like-minded people moving to the same areas. Another reason could be how different groups prioritize different values, says Jan Volkel, an assistant professor of public policy at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. It's very clear that Democrats and Republicans both really care about morality, and just that they care about a different kind of morality. Democrats might be focused more on issues of reducing harm and fostering fairness, while Republicans value a form of loyalty seen as patriotism, he says. Republicans also think that it is really important to respect certain traditions, he adds. Democrats do not necessarily think that that is a strong moral value in itself. Yet he notes something important. While Republicans and Democrats' dislike for each other has grown enormously, their differences on actual policy haven't changed much. Our differences have less to do with the facts and policy and rational thinking, and much more to do with emotion and identity and fear, says Amanda Ripley, author of High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. She calls it a revenge cycle, and Lucas Carvalho can see that. The student at Northeastern University in Boston pauses outside class on a crisp New England day. In general, he believes that the majority of people are quite moral, he says. But I think that people just have a bad outlook on other people. Mr. Carvalho sees a lack of community contributing to a knee-jerk judgmentalness. I would say as a society, I think we're more individualistic, he says, because we're not as much of a community nowadays. People aren't as open to new ideas. As a result, the slightest thing can tick someone off. In theory, the solution is fairly straightforward, says Mr. Ripley. It's about building relationships across divides. People want to trust each other. People want to live in a country where they can feel proud of their neighbors. That's a very basic need, says the author. If we think the other side or our neighbors are really immoral, then we find evidence that they're not as immoral as we thought. People do react in a positive way to that. That remedy would have been very familiar to Alexis de Tocqueville, the French historian who chronicled America in the 1830s. To him, what made America exceptional was the art of associating beyond the strict class lines that divided Europeans of that era. Americans of all ages, all conditions, all minds, constantly unite, he wrote, in Democracy in America. Americans use associations to give fetes, to found seminaries, to build inns, to raise churches, to distribute books, to send missionaries to the antipodes. In this manner, they create hospitals, prisons, schools. It might be getting harder to see this principle in action stateside, but it rings true to Anissa Nurul Utami. In her work as a high school principal in Garut, in the mountainous Indonesian province of West Java, she's worked closely with Muslims and non-Muslims alike. She's witnessed many admirable qualities, such as charity, respect, tolerance, across demographic lines. I think morality itself isn't a single fixed thing, she says. It's influenced by many factors that are interconnected In Indonesia, religion is definitely a strong foundation. It can strengthen things like cooperation and Gotong Royong, or the Indonesian idea of shouldering burdens together. But everyone has the capacity to be moral, she says, whether it's for spiritual reward, obedience to God, or simply to live harmoniously with others. And here's a related story from April 12th. Hungary election results echo worldwide after Viktor Orban ousted. By Mark Sappenfield, senior global correspondent. April 12, 2026, Berlin. Car horns are honking and people were dancing in the streets of Budapest all around her, yet Julie Keeps was still not sure she could believe it. Prime Minister Viktor Orban had lost. More than that, the man who had ruled Hungary for 16 years, often with what critics felt was the clenched fist of autocracy, brooking no dissent, had been politically routed. His opponent's party, formed only 2 years ago, was on course for a two-thirds majority, strong enough even to amend the constitution. Viktor Orban has been an institution in Europe's conservatives, illiberal bloc for decades. Hungarians showed that they were tired of this rule as challenger Peter Magyar ousted the prime minister behind unexpectedly high turnout and support. The result is one that will send tremors far beyond Hungary or even Europe. Mr. Orban was an admitted hero and trailblazer for resurgent right-wing politicians from Finland to Germany. He was held up by U.S. President Donald Trump's administration as a model of what Europe could and should be. And he was obstructor-in-chief for the European Union, Russia's most loyal friend, a vetoer of all things pro-Ukrainian, and a standard bearer for those who feel the EU is perpetually undermining the sovereignty of its member nations. Now he has been ousted in a defeat far more comprehensive than the polls or pundits imagine possible. With more than 98% of the vote counted early Monday morning, the opposition TISA party of Peter Magyar was headed for 138 seats in parliament. Mr. Orban's Fidesz party was on track for 55, and the far-right Our Homeland party set for 6. Ms. Keeps was stunned. "We're in shock," she said at an election night watch party. "Honestly, it's something that is very difficult to grasp." The election brought out a record number of voters, with Hungary's youth appearing to play a pivotal role. High inflation and a stagnant economy have forced many to look abroad for jobs. But 16 years of what Mr. Orban himself said was an increasingly illiberal democracy, also seemed to have taken a toll. Some revelers Sunday night couldn't quite grasp that they were being able to express themselves openly. Critics have accused Mr. Orban of dramatically curtailing free speech rights, as well as the rights of the press and the independence of the judiciary. "We are really excited," Ms. Keeps added. "We can't wait to see what will happen in an open and free Hungary." At times during Sunday night celebration, chants of "Europe" and "Russians go home" could be heard among the crowds, from squares to teeming metro stations. In his victory speech, Mr. Magyar declared that Hungarians had said yes to Europe. Certainly, Andreas Szesnes did. The mathematician and university professor said the result was not just an amazing evening for all Hungarians, but also a new day for Europe. "It will mean a shift in the Russian influence in European politics," he said, from the same election watch party. "It's a shift in power and a shift in the direction of unity of the European Union." Numerous European leaders agreed, with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer calling it an historic moment for European democracy. Not surprisingly, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky similarly hailed Mr. Magyar's win in a post on the social platform X, calling it a victory for a constructive approach. Mr. Orban had made Ukraine a centerpiece of his campaign, arguing that the war was not in Hungary's interests. In the EU, Mr. Orban has repeatedly stalled or blocked efforts to help Ukraine. For Mr. Orban's supporters, the results suggest that perhaps Hungary was not the bulwark of far-right politics that they had hoped it was. Speaking at an election night rally for Fidesz, a man who shared only his first name, Balit, said, "I am disappointed because I thought we were doing better." To him, Hungary was a beacon for Europe that has lost its way. Fidesz was against the migrants. They were against woke and the liberal nonsense. "We are the last bastion of this Christian democratic thinking in Europe, and we thought that the future of Europe is not based in Brussels, the EU thinking," he added. "We thought that Europe is based in the strong nations." Mr. Orban accepted the result early, calling Mr. Magyar to concede by 9:30 p.m. local time. He called the result of the election clear and painful, but vowed to fight on. "We never give up. This is one thing people know about us. We never give up." This story was supported by reporting from Budapest, Hungary. And a story from Law and Courts. Which countries offer birthright citizenship? Here's how the U.S. compares. By Henry Gass, staff writer. This is from April 1st, 2026, 5 o'clock a.m. ET. In one of the most anticipated cases of the year, the U.S. Supreme Court on April 1st will enter arguments about President Donald Trump's efforts to reinterpret the Constitution's guarantee of automatic citizenship at birth. Mr. Trump once said that the United States is the only nation that grants citizenship to anyone born in the country, a policy known as birthright citizenship. In fact, about 36 countries provide for unrestricted citizenship at birth. It's true that many countries around the world have chosen in recent decades to tighten or get rid of their birthright citizenship policies. The case, Trump versus Barbara, concerns whether an executive order issued by Mr. Trump that makes the children of unauthorized immigrants born in the U.S. ineligible for citizenship complies with the 14th Amendment. Barbara is a pseudonym for one plaintiff, a pregnant Honduran woman who is part of the class action challenge. The amendment, enacted after the Civil War, holds that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. The clause has long been interpreted to mean that any child born in the U.S. is automatically a citizen. The Supreme Court affirmed that reasoning in an 1898 decision. Since the 1980s, some have argued that the words "subject to the jurisdiction thereof" provide grounds for narrowing that interpretation. The Trump administration argues that immigrants living in the U.S. illegally are not subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S., and that therefore their children are not entitled to citizenship at birth. In the Barbara case, the Supreme Court will be weighing those differing interpretations. Outside the United States, countries have been having the same debates for decades. In fact, many countries in the Eastern Hemisphere have changed laws from citizenship by place of birth to citizenship by parental nationality. The United Kingdom passed a law in 1981 that replaced birthright citizenship. France did similarly with a law passed in 1993. Ireland made the change in 2004, with 80% of the population voting to end birthright citizenship in a national referendum. Germany is one of several nations around the world with a combination of the two policies. After declaring itself not an immigration country, in the 1980s, Germany adopted a limited form of birthright citizenship in 2000. A Across the Atlantic Ocean, almost every country in the Americas has unrestricted birthright citizenship. In many cases, those nations have enshrined birthright citizenship in their constitutions. A key reason for birthright citizenship laws in the New World is precisely that it was thought of by Europeans as the New World, which is to say largely empty and in need of people, says Kim Lane Schappel, a professor at Princeton University, in an email. But now, in the United States, the facts on the ground have changed, says Andrew Arthur, a resident fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies, which advocates stricter immigration policies. You no longer need to have that very liberalized immigration policy to promote development, because the United States is largely developed today, he says. This is clearly a trend that has been continuing in Western countries, such as the UK and France, he continues. The U.S. has not been isolated from the political and ideological forces that have led to legal changes in Europe, says Martha Jones, a history professor at Johns Hopkins University. We've been debating birthright since the 1980s, she adds. You could say it's part of the one broad rethinking of belonging in an age in which, in some quarters, the view is that changing demographics needs to be halted, needs to be contained. That's true in Europe, and that's true here. What is different in the United States compared with most of Europe is that, in the view of many legal scholars, birthright citizenship is enshrined in its constitution, and that the U.S. Constitution is notoriously difficult to amend. Raising it to the level of constitutional principle does, I think, make birthright citizenship more durable, more ineradicable than a national law in the U.S., says John Torpe, a sociologist at CUNY Graduate Center. Thus, the justices will be more focused on the 14th Amendment than on how the rest of the world has been reviewing its citizenship laws, says Mr. Arthur. This Supreme Court isn't going to involve itself in a policy at all, he adds. They're going to be looking at a lot at the floor debates in Congress in 1868 and the 14th Amendment itself. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.